In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with Dr. Mike T. Nelson from the Flex Diet Certification and host of the Flex Diet podcast. Mike and I speak about the link between HRV and longevity, metabolic flexibility, physiologic flexibility, and his book, Triphasic Training. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Mike. And please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Mike. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Mike T. Nelson from the Flex Diet Certification and host of the Flex Diet podcast. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Yes, thank you so much. We appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's exciting to talk to you about all things metabolic flexibility, heart rate variability, longevity in general. So I'm looking forward to getting into that. But before we do, I would just love to have a little bit of a snapshot of or how you got into what you're doing today, essentially.
Yeah, probably like most guys, I started lifting weights in, it wasn't until my first year of college. And I didn't do very well. I was, even in my first year of college, I was a 6'3" eel-shaped rake at like 156 pounds. So figured, hey, maybe I should do some lifting stuff. So signed up for a class to do that. And then in high school, like if you could pick someone to be on your team, like I don't know what you had when you were growing up, but like they had, you know, this side picks, that side picks. So I was always the last person to be picked. And there's usually some argument about, do we really have to have them on our team? Can we just play with one person short? And it turns out I found out later in life I had some eye issues where I didn't see in 3D. So I thought it was just normal that when you're a kid and unathletic, you just get hit in the face with balls and that's just kind of your life. But I found out later that that's not normal. but the good part is, I think that gave me an interest in all things physiology. I also had an open heart procedure when I was 4.5. So I had an atrial septal defect that was surgically repaired. And so as you get older, you're looking back on those things, you're like, oh, wow, that probably had an effect on, you know, I took anatomy and physiology as an undergrad, did a Bachelor of Arts in Natural Science, and then actually went into engineering. So I did postgraduate work at Michigan Tech and then did a master's in mechanical engineering, looking primarily at biomechanics and heat transfer stuff. Got done with that, still just kept taking exercise phys classes for fun and started working for a biomed company. They did cardiac implantable pacemakers, defibrillators. Went back to school again for more physiology stuff because they would pay for it for a while. And I was even in a PhD program in biomedical engineering. Dropped out of that because I didn't want to do any more math. And then went over and started my PhD in exercise physiology. That took 7 years, finished that up. And started training clients, I'd say, officially in 2005. I probably spent 5 years learning about physiology and just working on other clients, but never charging them any money. It wasn't really a business. 2005, did my NSCA cert, started training clients, worked at a local gym for a while, and then moved everything to online. And then, yeah, so now I do a bunch of stuff. I do some consulting for some people in the supplement industry. So I consult for Tecton, they make a ketone ester, do some part-time work for Rapid Health Optimization, and then have my own business, Extreme Human Performance, where I work with clients online, do some teaching through the Kerrig Institute and Rocky Mountain University, and then obviously the Flex Diet Certification and podcast.
So needless to say, you keep your hands full.
Yeah, it's been a little busy. And then I did write another book with, and it was behind me, the Triphasic 2 book with Coach Cal Dietz, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, which is great.
Oh, amazing. Well, I can't wait to hear more about it. Where I kind of wanted to start, though, was actually on HRV and longevity, because
sure.
I think HRV is something that is thrown around more and more, especially now with wearables, and people are like, oh, my HRV is this, and comparing and so on. But maybe you can actually explain what that means and why and how that's connected with longevity.
Sure. How I got into it when I did my PhD, I transferred over and the very first meeting we had, my advisor comes in. He's like, hey, we got two new projects and they both involve math. One's on heart rate variability, one's on metabolic flexibility. There's only like six people at an apartment at the time. And so he looks around the table and he points, he's like, you math boy, whatever your name is, like, these are your projects now. I was like, oh, I don't want to do any more math. That was 16 years ago now. And I had heard of it at the time through Omega Wave and through, other companies and working in the industry and talking to people and stuff. But the key thing is, we know you can measure resting heart rate, or during sleep, it'll give you an average heart rate. Now, that gives you some pretty good information. Is it 70, 60, 40? But if we do what's called a variability analysis, which I'll explain what that is, that gives us the next level down of information. So that'll actually tell us the status of what's called our autonomic nervous system. So our autonomic nervous system is roughly split into two branches. One is the parasympathetic, one is the sympathetic side. So I explained to clients and when teaching that imagine it's just like a car, right? The parasympathetic side is the brake of the car. If you push down harder on the brake, the car is going to slow down. You increase what's called vagal tone, push hard on the brake, the car will slow down, heart rate slows down, it's more rest, relaxation, that arm of it. On the sympathetic side is like the gas pedal on the car. You push down harder on the gas pedal, you exert more stress on the engine, but things like heart rate, performance, other aspects go up. And the autonomic nervous system, you can get an assessment of that by looking at heart rate variability. So heart rate variability, and there's different ways you can measure it, but simply it's telling you how far are you kind of on that sympathetic side, how far are you on that parasympathetic side. And how it does that is by looking at how much variability there is from one beat to the next. And so most people have the assumption that if we're just sitting here doing this podcast, that your heart rate is just like a metronome. It's, 51 beats a minute, 51, 51. And in reality, if you measure it in someone who's healthy, you'll see it's 49.5, 50.7, 51.0, 50.3. It'll oscillate around this kind of average. And those small and tiny oscillations, that's actually the small variability that we see. And the more of that small variability we have, the more heart rate variability we have, the more you're on the parasympathetic rest and digest arm of the nervous system. As that variability starts going away, which it does with exercise, especially high intensity exercise, then you're more on the sympathetic side. So by using math, and there's different mathematical ways to quantify that amount of variability, that gives us a nice marker for the status of your autonomic nervous system at that time, which is, it doesn't tell you everything, but I think now that you're able to measure that daily and get a trend for you as an individual, it becomes super useful.
Yeah, I think when it comes to like the Oura Ring or whatever, I heard from many people that, for instance, it would pick up before they got COVID or sick or whatever, like a
Sure.
few days in advance, like kind of like an alert, and they're like, "Oh, I'm feeling fine. What are you talking about?" And it's like saying, "Oh, your heart rate variability is indicating something is coming up." So that makes perfect sense in the way that you explained it. And so, how is that directly connected with longevity, or how can we tell from that, whether we're quote unquote healthy or not?
Yeah, so there you're looking at the average heart rate variability over time. So many months to potentially many years, depends on what study you're looking at. But you're going to grab it for a certain period of time, and that's going to be your baseline. So I think of heart rate variability can be used as kind of the macro baseline of where you're at, and then more the micro, like what are your day-to-day changes? Should I really push training today? Am I feeling a little bit sick? Where's my day-to-day stress level at? We do know from a fair amount of studies now that have been replicated, like they've heart rate variability is a new topic, but I mean, it's been around since probably the 60s. So it was originally developed by the Russian cosmonauts, because when they chucked people into outer space back then, they literally were very, very limited on what they could send for information. And so they needed a way to send just literally small bites of information through radio waves back to Earth to figure out what the health of the cosmonauts were. So they realized if they transmit the heart rate data, they could then use computers, back on Earth to determine what their HRV was. And so it's kind of escalated, from there. And it goes back further in time than that with the concepts and stuff like that. There's some Chinese things stating that if your heart beats like a metronome, you have very limited time to live. Fast forward, we have a lot of studies showing that a higher HRV is definitely associated with better longevity. The hard part then is everyone's like, ooh, well, is mine good enough? Like, what is the number? Like, what number do I need to see? And it's not a nice linear response. Like the two things we know for sure is if your HRV is really, really crappy, that's not very good for longevity. If it's moderate to high, yep, that's definitely better for longevity. Everything in between is a little messy because there's different studies, there's different ways of measuring it, there's different technology. And again, it's not a nice linear thing. So if we use the Aura scale, for example, my personal bias, if I see someone that's in the teens or single digits or even low 20s, unless we know for some reason they're really pushing training hard, or we know that there's some reason they're stressing their system on purpose, I'm like, yeah, you probably want to do something to increase that. You know, an Aura, I think if you're, 40 to 80, yeah, I think that's probably pretty good. Do I see a huge benefit from 80 to 100 to 120? Not really. The other part too is that there's a highly genetic component to it. Like I've seen people with horrible lifestyles, high resting heart rate, smoke, drink, do all sorts of crazy stuff. Their HRV is not too bad. Now, again, is that going to protect them for everything? No. But there is a pretty high genetic component to it. So, yeah, it gets a little bit messy, but in general, we do know that better HRV or more on the parasympathetic side, more fine scale variability is definitely associated with longevity. How much and how much exactly that buys you gets messy because HRV is also highly tied into the status of your aerobic system. So we have very good data showing that your higher your VO2 max is, that is incredibly protective for cardiac mortality, up to a hazard ratio of even like 5x, or I should say 5.0, sorry, which is bananas. So that goes from like the lowest level to the highest level. Smoking, for example, is like a 1.4, 1.3 hazard ratio, meaning that if you just stop smoking, you'll improve your chance of living longer, at least from a coronary or a coronary event, by 30 to 40%. We know that HRV is massively associated with the status of your aerobic system too. So it gets a little bit messy, but it's definitely a very good, rough approximation of where you're at.
Right. So you kind of alluded to some quote unquote practical takeaways for the listener. So not smoking, first and
Yeah.
foremost. Secondly, doing some cardio activity. What would be some other ways to improve your HRV?
Yeah, I think of it as there's two aspects to HRV. So imagine like if this was a glass here and the amount of fluid in it is my heart rate variability level. Most people have a glass that just has a ton of massive holes in it. Like they sleep 4 hours a night, they drink 8 cups of coffee, they're stressed out of their mind, their breathing mechanics are dog crap, their nutrition's a floating trash bin fire. Like they're just losing fluid out of there like crazy. So the first thing I do with clients is like just plug the holes in your current lifestyle. Like try to get a little bit more sleep, try to increase the quality of your sleep. Like eat some good nutrition, eat some micronutrition. Green Skittles don't count as micronutrition. Like actually have some vegetables. They're not going to kill you. Like do those things and get those things kind of up to par. So like plug most of the holes in at first. So once you've done that, so now you're not just losing a ton of fluid or HRV everywhere as a stress response. If you want to go to the next level and actually increase the sort of the size of the container or how much stress you can handle, once you've kind of fixed all those other things, the big hammers I see for that are probably aerobic training is probably number one. You can do a VO2 max test if you're not sure. So roughly you could do a 12-minute Cooper run test. So take 12 minutes, run as far as you possibly can in 12 minutes. Just type it out online, it'll tell you. I do a lot with the Concept 2 rower. You can do a 2,000-meter row. They've got an equation that'll transfer that. Like those are probably the biggest two. You know, there's a walk test and YMCA step test and some other ones like that if you're a little bit more deconditioned. But for most of the listeners, those are probably your main two. And then just compare yourself to population status. For me, compared to population status, not athletic status, I would want almost all my clients to be on the far right end, like above average. Because again, you're compared to a population which is generally detrained. Once you've done that, like there's some other things that help, like essential fatty acids, fish oil can make a pretty big difference. Breathing mechanics will make a massive difference that people don't talk about. If basically your rib cage is really stuck and frozen, your mechanics are going to be much more sympathetic driven. So some of the indicators for that are if people have a tight neck all the time, their traps are always like super tight. They're kind of using those upper respiratory muscles a lot. That makes a huge difference with that. Those would probably be the big ones. You know, after that, you get into some real weird esoteric stuff with scars and visual and vestibular inputs and stuff like that. But those are only normally an issue if someone's got some huge deficiencies in those areas.
Awesome, I love it. Thank you so much for these tips. I specifically also like the note on the breath. I think just in general, we can really manipulate our nervous system so well through breath work. I mean, not just
Oh, definitely.
how we breathe from minute to minute, but even if we're like feeling anxious and trying to bring ourselves down, or if we want to get ourselves amped up for an awesome lift or something like that, you know, and on the other end of the spectrum. So I think that's a really, really great note there. As we were starting, you were also saying that your advisor at the time said, "Who wants to write about metabolic flexibility?" That actually sounds really interesting to me as well. And my first question there would be, do we want to be metabolically flexible? Like someone might hear that, might hear metabolic flexibility. A, what does that actually mean? And is that a good thing if I'm metabolically flexible or not?
Yeah. So we know that metabolic flexibility is a marker of health. We know that people who have a disease, sort of like type 2 diabetics, they become very much less metabolically flexible. In the fitness world, I think we've, I don't know, done it maybe an okay job of talking about calories, although there's still people that swear calories don't matter and that's still kind of a disaster. But I think we've done an okay job at it. But I think there's been an overemphasis on only the amount of calories. Again, does not mean the calories don't matter. Yes, calories in, calories out work. I published research in thermodynamics. I had to suffer through all those classes. Like, I get it. Physics still works. However, the subcomponent of that is also what fuel are you actually using to do the task? And so, for metabolic flexibility, on one end is carbohydrate use. So, kind of the right end of the barbell example. And then the other end is how well can your body use fat? So kind of the other end of the barbell and the other end of the spectrum. And the third component is how well can you switch back and forth between those? So when you go do a heavy weight training session or some high intensity interval training, you want the ability to use carbohydrates for the highest level of performance. If you've ever done like a massively restricted carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet, or you can look at, there's even diseases where people are missing the enzyme to take down glycogen. It's called McArdle's disease. They are massively impaired on their ability to do intense exercise, which again, you don't want. You want to get the maximum amount of adaptation for the work you're putting in. You don't want to be limited just by a fuel source you're using. On the other end of the spectrum, if you're doing low to moderate intense work, you want the ability to downregulate and use fat primarily as a fuel. It's more efficient. There's a bunch of other benefits. And in my biased opinion, that yes, calories do matter. It's going to be easier for you to execute a diet of reduced calories if your body is really good at using fat as a fuel. And I think that's something that people forget because the calories in, calories out would be, we'll just slash calories and don't worry about it. Ah, if you burn carbohydrates, whatever, it doesn't matter. Yes, but the caveat is you're going to have to white knuckle your way through a whole bunch of stuff and you're just making your life harder. And I would argue you're also diminishing your health at the same time long term. So again, I think there's a better way to do it and, you know, get the same, if not a better result.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So essentially, yes, we want to be metabolically flexible is the take home message. Is there something in particular in terms of practices that we can do? So I would assume that let's just say someone who's coming out of the carnivore or keto diet for the last 3 months, they're probably not very efficient at using glycogen, or am I mistaken in that assumption? Or are they maybe even more so efficient at using it because they're so depleted?
Yeah, so we don't have much data on carnivore at all that I can find. We do have some data from protein modified sparing fasts, and anecdotally, it doesn't look like the carnivore diet impairs carbohydrate use as much as I would have thought. Now, again, that's highly anecdotal. We don't have a lot of research that's even looked at that per se. That may be because you're probably turning over a lot of protein into glucose, which is a pretty expensive process. We do have much more data on long-term ketogenic diets. We do know for sure on that you do have a downregulation of the body's ability to use carbohydrates to the fullest degree. And that is because insulin levels are going to be lower, but the two main things that happen are there's an enzyme called PDH or pyruvate dehydrogenase. The listeners can just think of it as it's your kind of your metabolic gatekeeper to glycolysis or your ability to use carbohydrates. When you do a long-term ketogenic diet, because you literally haven't used carbohydrate metabolism to the highest degree, you lose adaptations in that. You know, it's the old saying, use it or lose it. And for the longest time, when I first started looking at metabolic flexibility, I was like, hey, we know you get a massive upregulation of the use of fat as a fuel from a ketogenic diet. So I'm like, great, let's do ketogenic diet for those people that need that end of the spectrum. And then let's just transition them back to carbohydrates when they need to go weight train, you know, sort of like a cyclic ketogenic diet. And I kept trying with clients and it was a freaking disaster. It like never worked, didn't work that well. So again, started looking at the literature. And because that enzyme doesn't change real fast, again, it's not a permanent change. It will take you sometimes weeks to months to change it back. It means that acutely, like if you were doing keto Monday through Friday and you have a heavy deadlift day on Saturday and you want to use carbohydrates, even if we gave you a piss ton of carbohydrates on Friday night or Saturday morning, you can't use them to the fullest degree. So if you look at speed and power and just high-end performance, you'll lose about 8 to 10% off the top end, which again, if you're a recreational athlete and you're not getting close to that, probably doesn't matter a lot. But if you're even at, I would say, an intermediate to an advanced athlete, like that is a massive difference. If you're an elite athlete, that's just like a freaking another universe, you know. So that's the kind of the downside with the ketogenic diet. Carnivore diet, we don't know yet. What is cool though, that there is a workaround that's similar but yet different. So what I found was doing intermittent fasting for short periods of time does not change the PDH enzyme and does not alter carbohydrate use. And so when I designed the Flex Diet Cert initially, I was trying to find something that wasn't exercise that would upregulate the body's use of fat. And what I found was, as simple as it is, just doing a period of fasting. So consume water, consume electrolytes. And then what you find is insulin levels go down over time, pushes the body to use more fat as a fuel source. And the beautiful part is you can literally come back the next day with a high amount of carbohydrates and be perfectly fine. So like in an extreme case, I've had multiple clients now, possibly like Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, like they're super heavy weight training days. Like they may be on 400 to 600 grams of carbohydrates on those days. Tuesday might be a fasting day where they're just doing low intensity cardio. So they'll work up to a 19 to 24 hour fast. Wednesday, they're back to 400 to 600 grams of carbohydrates again. Like no problem with those transitions.
Wow, that yeah, that's
Yeah.
actually blown my mind a little bit. That's a very impressive, absolutely, and I would not
Yeah.
have.
And that's the extreme end. I'm not saying people need to start that as a, you know, where you would start. That's like the extreme end of the spectrum. But I always like testing the extreme stuff because if it works on that end, we'll just titrate people back down to where they are and they'll be fine.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess in order to improve metabolic flexibility, you mentioned fasting, you mentioned, around training, higher carb intake, but perhaps if we're just sedentary or we're just doing some walking or something like that, having meals that are heavier in healthy fats, would that be a strategy to kind of quote unquote teach your body to be more metabolically flexible?
It can. The weird part about unless you do a ketogenic diet, like higher amounts of fat don't seem to upregulate fatty acid oxidation. So in a ketogenic diet, what you're doing, and for your listeners, is very, very low carbohydrates, probably under 100, probably under 50 grams in some cases, like vegetables. Like you ate a half a bagel for breakfast, like you shot your whole carbohydrates for the whole day. In that case, because baseline levels of insulin are so low, insulin's like this fuel selector switch. When it's low, it's going to push your body to use more fat. And in a ketogenic diet, you've got very low levels of insulin, very low levels of carbohydrate. Your body will then, liver will convert them into different ketone bodies, which can be used as fuel sources. And in those circumstances, you do upregulate the use of fat as a fuel. Now, I do have some bones to pick with how that was done with metabolic hearts and ketone testing and everything else, but in general, it does upregulate the use of fat. So people then thought, oh, well, this means if I just consume more fat, I'll burn more fat. And the answer, unfortunately, is probably not. Because if you have a moderate level of insulin, and we look at, so if we take a healthy person, right? So we'll do two examples. So, healthy person, metabolically flexible, and we give them two Pop-Tarts for breakfast, right? And a healthy individual, their baseline metabolism will actually switch to carbohydrate oxidation. The body says, hey, all these carbohydrates came in, insulin levels go up. That means we're going to push the body to use more of these carbohydrates as a fuel source. The way to use more fat as a fuel source is actually to, again, lower insulin levels. So when you consume fat, it is true that you don't necessarily increase insulin. There is no insulin response. But most people are having a mixed meal. Most people are having kind of a moderate insulin response. And when that's happening, your body will kind of burn more of the fuel that's present. And fats are just much easier to be stored. If you think about the process, carbohydrates have to go to be stored, is they have to come in, they have to be in excess. Insulin levels generally have to be high, not always. There's non-insulin dependent pathways that'll do this. It has to go to the liver. Liver has to convert it to something called the DNL, de novo lipogenesis. That has to convert the carbohydrates to fat, and that fat has to go in the bloodstream and then be stored as fat on your body. Does that happen? Yes. Rates of that in humans, probably single digits, so very, very low. Rodents are the exception. Rodents have an incredibly high rate of DNL. Like you feed them a bunch of carbohydrates, they'll get fat right away. But humans, not so much that are healthy. The long story and all of that to say is if you feed someone a higher amount of carbohydrates, they will switch to use more carbohydrates as a fuel. If you put them in a low insulin condition, like a ketogenic type diet, or you lower insulin levels, yes, you will burn more fat as a fuel. Outside of that, if you're in this kind of mixed meal type thing, it doesn't really upregulate it. So the things there I'm looking at are movement. Walking will just pull energy right out of the bloodstream. What is your VO2 max? So we know that just having a bigger aerobic engine, if we don't change what percentage fuels are being used, right? So if I have a V10 Corvette engine versus a V3 Yugo engine, I'm going to burn a lot more gas using the Corvette engine. Right. So I tell clients, you just want a bigger engine because you're just going to burn through more fuel. Some of that's carbohydrates, but a lot of it's going to be fat also. And then outside of that, you can purposely exercise under low insulin conditions, you know, the old school fasted cardio, that type of thing. Yes, I will preferentially burn more fat acutely. Is that the holy grail is going to solve all your issues? Not necessarily. Your calories and all that stuff still do matter, but it is one method that you can due to try to target more use of fat. My argument is most of that is going to be low to moderate intensity exercise anyway. I'll take the benefit of using fat as a fuel for that. I don't need to fuel that with carbohydrates anyway. There's a few other side benefits, but the whole fasted cardio thing could be another podcast in and of itself.
Absolutely. No, that was a great explanation. Thank you so much. Another term I saw on your social media page, similar to metabolic flexibility, was sorry, now I can't say it, physiologic flexibility.
Yeah.
What exactly do you mean by that? And do we want to be physiologically flexible?
Yeah. So when I started doing my PhD on metabolic flexibility, which the original the term was coined by David Kelly in like the year 2000, it's based on work from like Brooks and Mercier, which is back in the early 90s, and based on work even well before that. I started thinking, I'm like, well, that's pretty cool. Like, your body wants to switch back and forth in these kind of paired systems, right? Even biomechanically, like most muscles in the body are paired. Like, you have biceps and triceps, and you have your quads in the front, your hamstrings in the back. Like, there's always these paired kind of type push-pull type systems in the body. And I was like, okay, so if the theory is this kind of what I call HDR, or human dynamic range, we want better adaptations would be a lower heart rate to a higher max heart rate. And we want this bigger range, and we want to be able to oscillate faster between those ranges. Parasympathetic to sympathetic. How well can you downregulate? How well can you upregulate? How fast can you move back and forth? Metabolic flexibility. How well can you use carbohydrates? How well can you use fat? How well can you expand those end of the spectrums? And again, still switch back and forth between the two. Exercise performance on a high level for sports. If you're sprinting, how fast can you switch between using your quads and using your hamstrings, right? You know, extension, flexion, etc. So I'm like, okay, so if that's true, then what would be like the highest level in terms of you as an entire physiologic organism? And let's say that we'll give you like a B for your nutrition, your exercise, and your sleep, right? So those things are covered, which are definitely important. People definitely need to do those things. You've got lots of great podcasts on that. What's next? Like, what's the framework of how you would decide what are the other things you should be doing? Is it, you know, red light? Is it methylene blue? Whatever. Like, how do you have some framework to decide? And so what I came up with is that I just called it physiologic flexibility. And I looked at, okay, well, what things in the physiologic system does your body have to hold constant, or you're going to be in a world of hurt? So temperature, right? We know humans are homeotherms. We like, you know, 98.6. It's actually closer to 97.7. However, we could put you in cold. We could stick you out in the snow for a little while. We could stick you in a sauna, right? Again, these things are limited. But we also know there's things as cold acclimation or heat acclimation. There's tons of research going back for hundreds of plus years on this. We know that you can adapt and expand that human dynamic range over time. I'm like, okay, cool. So like, what else do we have to hold constant? pH. If the pH of the blood gets off even by a tiny amount, like you're in a world of hurt. There's all these compensation mechanisms to make sure that still runs well. We could expand our fuel systems into lactate and ketones, right? So expanding that out even further. And the last one would be regulation of oxygen and CO2. So my bias with the physiologic flexibility is like the four pillars are temperature, pH, expanded fuels, and then air, right? O2, CO2 and O2, carbon dioxide and oxygen. If you get better at training those specific systems, I just think your recovery, your ability to be more robust, like you're expanded, there's things like physiologic headroom. I just think you're just gonna be a much harder human to kill overall. And I think that is directly related to your health also. Like most people want the ability to do what they want, you know, chase their kids, you know, go on vacation. I do a lot of kiteboarding, go lift weights, whatever. They want the ability to recover to get back to baseline faster. So I think once again, you've got nutrition, exercise, and sleep good. To me, those would be the next areas. And when we've worked with clients in those areas, we've seen their HRV actually go up also. So we've seen these other approximate markers in the background go up. Last part on that is that it doesn't take a lot of training to do because most people are incredibly ill or undertrained in those areas. Most people, even if they live in Minnesota or Arizona or wherever, run like if you're in Arizona, like people always laugh at me because I live in Minnesota. I'm like, but you just run from one air-conditioned place to the next. Like you're not really ever outside that often. You know, in Minnesota, there's people that barely go outside of their house ever in the winter. So I think we've lost those stimuluses over time. And I think that's going to be to our detriment. But because we are so untrained in those areas, it doesn't take a lot to get a nice training effect from it. It's not like you have to do sauna for hours per day or, you know, cold water immersion for, you know, 30 minutes a day or anything like that. You can put these in very, very small doses with a big payoff.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense also. And so physiologic flexibility, we want to be physiologically flexible. Yes, a great takeaway. And I think, yeah, the use of saunas and cold plunges and so on has become super popular. The thing I'm curious about, how do you become more flexible with your pH level?
Good question. So pH, your pH won't really change, right? So the interesting part of all these markers is we're not trying to necessarily change the marker. Like we're not really trying to change your core temperature because really, really bad stuff happens then. So you're not really looking to change your pH long term, but we can do things to make it more acidic and more basic. So on the acidity side, one of the main ones is going to be a high intensity exercise. So we put you on a rower and we tell you to do all out wind gates for 30 second repeats, and we have you do this over and over. Your body produces a lot of what's colloquially called lactic acid. Lactic acid doesn't really exist. It completely deforms into lactate and hydrogen ions. So lactate, it turns out, has all sorts of crazy features, may increase BDNF in the brain, may actually directly interact with your genome through a newly discovered method by George Brooks's lab. It is a really, really good high energy fuel. Like the cardiac system loves to use lactate. Muscles love to use lactate. The downside is normally when it's produced in the body by high intense exercise, you have all these hydrogen ions at the same time. The hydrogen ions are literally the definition of an acid. So as your muscle's producing this, it's literally dumping acid into the muscle at that time. There's other buffer systems that'll help that, both intramuscular and extramuscular. Intra is primarily if you've used the supplement beta-alanine. So beta-alanine combines with histidine to form intramuscular carnosine. Carnosine is a buffer of hydrogen ions. In the blood, you can use things like baking soda. The hard part is too much and you'll crap yourself, so you got to watch out for that. But there are different ways we can then buffer this. And the cool part is, even if you're not using any of those supplements, the body intrinsically will increase that buffering capacity as a result of you doing this crazy high intensity exercise stuff. On the basic side, it's a little bit trickier, but one of the main ones is like a supraventilation method, like a Wim Hof breathing or Tummo breathing, where you're breathing in and out really, really, really fast. And so what you're doing when you do that is you're actually off-gassing more CO2. And what happens with that is that it's pulling that out of the bloodstream temporarily. And in a temporary state, that will make your blood a little bit more alkaline. Now, again, there's pros and cons to all these things of when you would do them. Like doing Wim Hof breathing, for example, is very stressful. If your CO2 tolerance is really crappy in the background, you probably don't want to spend a lot of time doing that. But just in terms of examples, those would be two ways you can move the pH either up or down.
Very, very cool to hear that we can do that naturally. We don't need to buy any alkaline
No, I don't need
waters
to buy any alkaline
or
bullshit water or
any crappy thing like
anything.
that. So no, thank you. Yeah, that was very new to me, the thought of trying to become more flexible when it comes to your pH level. Now I would like to hear a little bit about your book. So it's called Triphasic
Sure.
Training, you said.
Yeah.
So first of all, what inspired you to write it? And second of all, of course, what can we, well, that looks like a lot to read and probably hard to summarize in about 10 minutes. But nonetheless, I'd love to hear, yeah, what inspired you to write it? And what kind of three phases are we talking about when we're talking about the triphasic training?
Yeah, so the original book was written by my buddy Coach Cal Dietz and Dr. Ben Peterson. So I've known Cal for, God, probably almost 20 years now, maybe over 18 years. And when I was doing my PhD at the University of Minnesota, the lab I was in, he was literally like right around the corner. So we spent a lot of time just exchanging different ideas and stuff. And the running joke was I was kind of the Cal translator for his staff. So after meetings, which I would just sit in, I was never on his staff, people would be like, "Hey, what did he actually say with this?" And I'm like, "Oh, it was like this, or that, you know." And so the joke was, it started off kind of as a joke like 9 years ago. I was like, "Hey, you should help me write a second book." And then eventually I said yes. And it took 9 years and a long time. And we started over 3 years ago because he had so much stuff. So if you go back to the original Triphasic book, what he noticed with his athletes was if they spent time working on the eccentric phase, the isometric, and the concentric phase separately, they got better results. So if you think about any muscle action has three phases. If you take a squat, right, you're going to unrack the squat. Eccentrically, you're going to lower it. There's that split second isometric pause, and then the concentric coming back up to the top again. So all muscle actions are triphasic, have three phases. What he found was if you spent, like, say, just a simple 2 weeks training the eccentric phase primarily first, then 2 weeks training the isometric phase primarily, the third, phase of it, usually they're like 2 or 3 weeks, and there's intricacies in how you set them up. But the third phase would be the concentric, just trying to come up as fast as possible. People got much, much better results by doing that, by having an emphasis on each one of the phases. And then in the second book, it's 14 high performance methods to unlock elite athletic development. So we took a lot of the other methods he's come up with along the way, everything from warm-ups to how you periodize programs to transferring it, so making sure your athletes are strong in the weight room, but actually strong on the field and in their games, which is what they actually get paid for. So we put a bunch of these other methods that have come about since then into a book. so that coaches and trainers and people can now look at it in more of a systematic way, which is like the that's what took the longest time, because in Cal's brain, everything was very systematic for that athlete going through. But some he's had, some of the same athletes for 4 years in a row, right? So how do you take these concepts where it's going to be different groups of athletes, it's going to be different sports, and then put them together in a system where people can kind of go through and take those different components and take those different methods and plug it into where they're at with their athletes.
Wonderful. Nothing better than practical, applicable takeaways rather than just some sort of systems or so that seem kind of out of reach. I actually was just listening to a podcast where they were talking about eccentric training and how much more we can load in many cases. So like 110% or sometimes even
Yes.
100%. 20 or so, and how that is affect. So from that point of view, it makes complete sense what you're saying that if we're splitting it up, that we would see enhanced performance afterwards or from that. I'm curious for the person listening that's just sort of like me, someone who loves going to the gym, lifting heavy, and they're following a training program and they maybe want to implement some of that triphasic training in their program. What would be something to sort of get started with?
Yeah, I mean, the simple way I've done this with several clients is there's two ways. One, if they're at not an advanced level, I've done old school tempo work and emphasize an eccentric. So I may say, hey, if you're doing a hack squat, I want you to take 4 to 6 seconds to lower it, pause, and then come up as fast as you can on every rep, right? So what am I doing? I'm basically just doing an eccentric emphasis to them. I also know that having watched hundreds of thousands of clients do shit over years, that's the phase on a hard lift, like a hack squat or something, where everything else is controlled. Like you don't have to worry about form on it. That's the one that you're normally gonna speed past really fast, right? Or you just go to the gym. Like, what do you see? Like the horrible bench press where the bar comes flying down and there. It's the eccentric is almost always just bastardized. So I know I might get a little better adaptations. I know I'm controlling form, those types of things. If somebody says, hey, maybe it's like you, and you're like, I really want to increase the weight I left on my squat. So, what I would do is take a 2, maybe 3 week phase, depending upon experience level. And so, when you squat, you're going to do a 4 to 6 second not pause, but count, like tempo work. But I want you to go as heavy as you can still control. And we might do 3 to 5 reps. Maybe do 3 sets. So by the end of that third set, like if you can't get up with the fourth rep at the bottom, we probably hit the load about right. Right. So it's pretty friggin' heavy, but we still want that eccentric phase control. And then depending on how you feel, how beat up you are, we might go into an isometric phase. So take the same squat again, go all the way down to the bottom, and now come up about 1 inch. And you're going to hold that bottom, that isometric position again for 4 to 6 seconds. Like the first time I ever did this, it was crazy to see how weak people are in that position, myself included. So do that for maybe 2 to 3 weeks, depending on your level, how often you train, etc. And then you would do the concentric phase where, go down and control, stop, and then come up as fast as you can. Most people, depending upon the level of stress that you see, their true performance increase may not come until maybe even 2 to 3 weeks after they finish the program. And so the tricky part is just monitoring the overall stress. Like the eccentric phase does get kind of nasty. Like it does, HRVs definitely go down. Like people, if you're really, really pushing it. But the cool part is, like you can gradate all of that to whatever level the person is at. You could have them do it less times per week. You could have them do less sets. You could have them do maybe fewer reps, but more controlled. But the key is it generally has to be heavy, heavy per individual. And then, 4 to 6 second, like eccentric or isometric for those phases.
It seems like a really good strategy to, as you said, and focus on form as well, because particularly for the squat, for example, I think when many people start off with, or so they bounce out of the bottom as well. As you said, it's not just the rushing down, it's also just the bouncing out of the bottom. And so essentially you kind of lose that tension. So if someone might be struggling with a certain mind muscle connection in a particular area, I could imagine that with that increased time under tension and by holding that tension in the bottom position, or yeah, in that point, that we actually improve the mind muscle connection as well.
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of beneficial nervous systems adaptation, mind muscle connection, rate coding, who knows? Like, but I do think I agree with you that there's a lot of beneficial things that happen. And then also, and Cal's talked about this a lot, on the eccentric, because it's so heavy and the volume is relatively high for that heavy of work, you're literally taking the actinomyosin and you're ripping them apart to some degree, right? You're literally popping the actinomyosin heads apart. And so you will see some more inflammation response. You will see some soreness. But the good part is the body goes back and rebuilds them back together. Then they're going to be just a little bit stronger. So now when you go down, you have more strength to slow down and to stop that weight at the bottom and reverse that direction. Now you add in, pausing with the isometrics, you're getting stronger at the bottom position. And for his athletes, what he found was the ones who could lower the weight faster, but stop it in control and come back were much, much better athletes. The ones who were really, really, really slow, had this long pause at the bottom and then were slow coming up. It was primarily that first part of that drop, the ability to drop and to stop that heavy load and reverse it was the rate limiter on their performance, just in the gym and both on the field.
Very interesting. Well, I will make sure to drop a link to the book in the show notes as well.
Yeah, thank you.
To sort of round off with, I would love to just hear a little bit about the Flex Diet certification. So first of all, how long does it take? What are sort of the modules or the pointers of it?
Yeah, so it right now is about, I think, 28 hours, so it's pretty long. And we've got a lot of expert interviews from like buddy Dr. Eric Helms has been on here, Dr. Stu Phillips, Jose Antonio, I'm blanking on the other guys. I don't know. There's a bunch of experts in there. Dr. Mike Ormsby, a bunch of people. I think we have like 12 experts in there for more details. And then what I did was I took what are the top eight interventions to improve metabolic flexibility? So if you're better at metabolic flexibility, it's a way to increase your health, improve body composition, and increase performance. And again, you can push those a little bit more in each specific direction, but you can kind of just, generally get better at all of those too. So the interventions are protein, fats, carbohydrates, so NEAT, micronutrition, exercise, sleep, and then fasting. And then what I did is I organized them in terms of something called coaching leverage. So initially, the first revision, which I didn't ever release, I had them all just lined up by physiologic response. And so, for example, sleep was like number two. Like, man, you don't get enough sleep, like a whole bunch of shit just goes really, really bad. There's nothing you can do to recover from it. Yeah, more caffeine will acutely save you, but there's a big cost associated, and you're just digging a bigger ditch because of it. What I realized though from coaching people for almost 20 years now is that trying to have conversations about sleep is really, really hard. I'd almost like want to put my head through a wall at this point because it always comes back to, yes, we can do things to increase your sleep. Yes, we can increase your quality. But at some point, like, man, if you're sleeping 4 hours a night, unless you're a DEC 2 mutant, which there's very few of those in the world, you just need more sleep. So, yes, maybe you don't watch 4 hours of Netflix and you go to bed and watch 2 hours of Netflix. It always cuts into something else they didn't want to give up. So with coaching leverage, what I realized was that to rank the interventions, it's the physiologic response times the client's ability to change. So times the psychological component. So for example, protein ended up being rated number one. Oh, lots of good physiologic reasons to have, protein, which you've had many guests talk about. And most people, if they think about dieting, you tell them, hey, I want you to eat more of this particular thing. They're like, what are you crazy? I thought dieting was just supposed to eat less. It's all about calories. It doesn't matter. So getting them to eat more protein was a pretty easy sell. Took a little education, a little bit of time, but most people could do it pretty easily. So protein ended up being number one, high physiologic response, high client ability to change. Sleep ended up being number eight, was dead last. Like super high physiologic response, but client's ability to change was like a freaking one. So it ended up rating dead last. And again, it wasn't because of the physiology. It's just that if you're a coach, and I've made this mistake many times, you look at someone like not sleeping enough and you instantly want to try to fix it. And that's probably the worst place to start. Again, it doesn't mean you never want to talk about it, doesn't mean you never want to address it. But it's like, if I can just get you eating more protein, get some buy-in, see some progress, maybe let's move on to fasting. Oh my God, you don't even have to eat for a period of time. How much easier is it than that? Right. And rig the system in their favor and get them results as you're doing it. So you still have to have a physiologic response. By the time you get to sleep, you can have some pretty decent conversations and you have a lot more leverage, you have a lot more buy-in, and it's just a lot easier at that point.
Super interesting. I love it. And I love the notion of like, hey, what's actually going to take effect? Because I mean, we know that even if something in textbook is supposed to be most helpful, if the person doesn't do it, and particularly doesn't do it consistently, there is absolutely no point of ranking that as number one. So really, yeah, sounds very logical. And I will also make sure to link
Thank
the
you.
Flex Diet certification in the show notes. So Mike, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a pleasure, super interesting, and I will put all your handles in the show notes as well. So yeah, truly, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And if people want more information from me, like probably 90% of my content goes out through the newsletter. So they can just go to miketnelson.com, little newsletter button at the top, and yeah, tell me you heard me here and I'll send you a cool free gift too. So
Oh,
thank you.
awesome. Very cool. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Mike. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.